Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thanks for downloading Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4. In this programme, I talk to Paul Weller. And if you're wondering by now who I am, look no farther than the mirror, because I am the greed and fear and every ounce of fate in you. Hello, welcome to Master Tapes. That's the sound of Paul Weller playing Carnation for our studio audience here at Maida Vale. That's one of the songs from the album The Gift, released by The Jam in 1982. In the first part of this edition of the programme, we heard how the young pop poet Paul Weller was writing about hard times and big decisions in songs like Town Called Malice and Running on the Spot, and how The Gift signalled the change in musical direction that would see the end of the biggest band in Britain and a new musical challenge for its frontman and songwriter. This is what we like to think of as the B-side of the programme. Now it's the turn of our studio audience to ask the questions, and we'll have some more live music from Paul. So let's start with a question from Joseph Bramley.
I was brought up with my parents telling each other, stop dreaming of a quiet life, because it's one you'll never know. How does it feel knowing that A Town Called Malice captured many people's lives, and do you think it still has its relevance now?
Well, it's a brilliant feeling, you know, because it's... You can never know those things when you're writing them. You know, when you first write a song, you have your aspirations for whatever song's going to mean to people. But the fact that it's endured is a great compliment to a song, I think. These days, when I play it, it's almost like it's what belongs to someone else. It's almost like it belongs to the people or something, you know. And in a weird way, it's the same thing wherever I play it. If I go to Australia or America, Japan, wherever it may be, it's always a similar, obviously, if not the same reaction. And why those songs connect, why a certain song connects to people, I don't know, I have no idea. If I did, I'd be knocking them out, do you know what I mean? But it's a great feeling.
Do you feel that with lots of your songs, that they have almost become, you've passed them on to us?
Yeah, certainly songs of, you know, from all those years ago, That's Entertainment's another one. To me, they become folk songs, you know, in the literal sense of it, and they're modern-day folk songs, I think.
And let me throw it back to Joseph Bramley. You say your parents grew up, you heard them saying, you know, you better stop dreaming of the quiet life. Literally, I mean, were they Jam fans?
Oh, yeah, no, they weren't just, like, randomly quoting it. No, like, I brought up the tape was in the car, holidays to, like, Wales.
Has it had a traumatic effect on you or not?
I'm here now, so I obviously quite liked it.
Let's have another question. This one's from Rob Bryan.
Throughout my life as a soldier, quite often found myself in some pretty dark places. I've always been able to find a track by The Jam or Style Council or your solo work that I can find some comfort in and, you know, pick myself up. Do you ever get down? And if you do, does music help you?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, definitely. I think it's just, you know, it's inspiration in itself, you know. There's an often asked question where people say, where's the inspiration come from? But for me, it's just the music itself is inspiring enough, is the inspiration in itself. It makes me see the possibilities in life again, and it means so many different things to so many different people, and I love that, and I think that's very unique in that sense. But it always inspires me, man. It makes me want to get up and smash the kitchen up.
Who would you listen to?
My musical outlook is much, much broader than when I was younger, you know. It was either the Beatles or it was sort of soul music, so it's broadened out considerably since then. But in my car, I'll go from, like, Brazilian music to maybe some old sort of soul tracks to a new band. You know, I like hearing all of it, really.
Rob, they're talking about serving as a soldier. There is a Jam song called Little Boy Soldiers, which you wrote. You're imagining yourself into the life of soldiers in, I guess, an imaginary conflict situation. What prompted that song?
I don't know what prompted it, but I think it was a very rewarding thing when I met some three or four squaddies when we were playing in Germany years and years ago, back in the Jam days. And I was a bit like, oh, I don't know what they're going to feel about it, you know, what they would think about my angle on it. But they were like, it's really spot on. And they just felt it really captured a lot of it, a lot of their lives.
In the audience today, we have the poet and publisher Michael Horowitz. Michael, you published Little Boy Soldiers as a poem in a collection, an anthology of poetry called The Grandchildren of Albion. What was it about that lyric in particular that you wanted to put there on the page?
Well, I put about 10 or 12 of Paul's songs in Grandchildren of Albion, but in New Departures 1981, I included some of his poetry and was already loving the Jam songs, and I think of them all, like a lot of great song lyrics, as poetry also. And I was going to ask Paul about one of my favourite Jam songs, Still Down in the Tube Station at Midnight, if you can recall the evolution of that song from first inklings through to the completed recording.
I think it came from my own insecurity and paranoia of being in London, and I thought, anyway, it was a very violent time, really. And you took your life and your arse in your own hands when you went into clubs at that time. You know, it was dangerous, I thought, anyway. This was kind of like sort of late 70s. I'd see a lot of people getting really badly beaten up at clubs. And again, I saw it as a kind of visual thing. I imagined it as like a little TV play thing, you know. I didn't really think of it as a lyric, and I just wrote it as a prose poem thing. And didn't think too much else of it. And then I showed it to my producer at the time, who said you should turn it into a song, you know. It was a big sort of tune for me because it was one of the first ones that people really started to take me seriously as a writer, and I thought that kind of spurred me on, really, you know.
Because it is a very violent story of the protagonist on his way home in the tube station with the takeaway curry that he's taking home to his wife.
You know, because it's like any sort of writing, some of it you kind of flesh out a bit as well, you know. As someone once pointed out, when I come, why were you getting a tube at 12 o'clock? Because they finished before that, but that's not the point, you know. It's the kind of metaphor, really. It's the image, you know. Yeah.
And do you make a distinction between the poetry and the lyrics? Do you keep them apart?
Not so much, really. With songs like Tube Station, and that was a Little Boy Soldier, actually. And there's, again, another one I wrote just as a story or prose or whatever. After I sort of found that you actually can make them into a song, it kind of opens up a wider field, really, to work in, you know. And in more recent years, I've not really thought about these lyrics. I've just thought of them as words. They haven't got to rhyme. They haven't got to have a meaning. I like the words.
Let's have another question from the audience. This one's from Katie Jones.
Do you find it easier to write music in a state of sadness or happiness?
I can write music in any state, really, to be honest with you. There is always that feeling that an artist turns out their best work when they're at the lowest point in their lives, which can be true sometimes, but I don't think it's the general rule. I think there's all different ways of writing. And, you know, I sort of see it that I'm a writer and I write whatever mood I'm in and whatever kind of period of life I'm going through, whether it's a great time, whether it's a lousy time. My job is to write.
And do you write whenever inspiration strikes? You don't have to sit... there's always a notebook to hand, then?
I've always got a notebook, yeah, and I just make little notes and I'll see what I've got at the end of a few months or whenever I feel I'm ready to write, I'll look through it and see what I like and what I don't like. And,
do you write under pressure? I mean, is there a different situation where you have to sit yourself down in an office and have to deliver a set of songs? Does that produce a different kind of song?
Well, yeah, it can do, yeah. I mean, I have done that in the past. I've had to. Two of the songs, which are two of my favourites on Setting Suns, one is called Private Hell and the other one's called Girl on the Phone, was exactly that. We had two more songs to finish this record and I sat in a little office in West London somewhere and I just wrote these two songs, you know, and they're two of the best ones, I think, really. The older I've got, the less pressure of me to complete something. And I guess there's also an element of being lazier when you get older. I mean, sometimes when I get an idea at night, I'm just about to fall asleep and I'm like, oh, I can't be bothered getting up, you know. So, whereas years ago, I would have got up and written that idea down, you know. But I also still believe as well that if it's any good, it'll come back to you.
And so you're always writing, there's always a lyric which is developing, and there's always a series of chords going through your head?
Not always, but quite often, yeah.
What's happening now?
I'm going to start recording again soon, and I would at least do some demos, and I'm probably just going to try and buy some instruments I can't play and just see what happens, or do something different, you know.
Really? What, learn the violin or something?
Well, not actually violin, I don't know, just to put myself in a place where I'm not familiar with anything and see what happens, you know.
Another question, this one's from James Clark.
You're right, Paul. I was just wondering if you're proud of all your work, or do you sometimes look back at tracks and think, what was I thinking when I made that?
Well, yeah, the latter, yeah. I'm not proud of all of it. But at the same time, you know, there's some records I don't really care to sort of think about or even listen to. But I also see them now that they're stepping stones to somewhere else, you know. It can't always be great. Life can't always be great. It's up and down, you know. And you look forward to the good bits and the creative parts, you know. And sometimes you have to go through the troughs, you know, to get to it. But I'm much more able to deal with that, and I see it more philosophically the older I've got as well. And there's times in my life when I'm really creative and I've got loads of ideas, and there's other times when it's a real struggle, you know. You can't necessarily do one without the other sometimes.
Yeah. James, I'm going to put you on the spot. No, in fact, I'm not. It'd be too cruel to ask you which of the ones you think he should have never committed to record. Are there any that you could out as the ones that you wish you'd never written?
No, I don't really. I don't see it like that. There's things I don't care if I don't ever hear again. But I don't, you know, no, you can't do that, you know. You were committed to them at the time. I mean, the songs, even at the time I was doing it, I was thinking, oh, I don't know, I just don't feel finished, you know, it's not great, but I had to do it.
Are there any that you hear by accident, they come on the radio, that you think, I don't want to hear that one again?
No, I'm always after hearing my records on the radio. It keeps me and my kids in food and clothing, so it's all good.
Andrew Pigeon's got our next question.
When around the time of The Gift, you decided to disband The Jam, you say it was your dad who you confided in first. How hard did he try to change your mind, if at all?
Just to remind people that your dad was managing the band.
Yeah, my dad was my manager, yeah. Well, it was tough, you know. He was shocked and disappointed. But he didn't really try and talk me out of it. You know, we didn't look alike, but we were very similar people, and we were both kind of, once we made our mind up, there's kind of no going back.
Did your dad have an inkling of what you were going to say? Did he know that you were heading to break the band?
No, I don't think so, no.
So it really came out of the blue when you sat down and said, I've got some news.
Yeah, it did, yeah. And the same thing probably for Rick and Bruce. They knew that there's no change in my mind, you know. They thought maybe I'd just go off and do my solo thing for a bit or something and come back, but it wasn't like that. I want a clean break and go, you know.
There's a related question from Brendan Ivy. Where's Brendan?
Do you feel vindicated in your decision to split The Jam at the height of their success? As without doubt, it's kept the band's legacy intact.
Yeah, I do feel vindicated. I think it's a lot of things that people like about that band and about the music is untainted, you know. It is of the time, but it's a lot of it's endured as well. You know, we haven't had 30 years of us continuing making lousy records, which is a case of some bands, you know. I take me out off to people like the Stones, but it's not for me, you know. I couldn't do that.
It's interesting at the time, though, when you split the band and you released a statement to the press, to the fans, and you said, I'm splitting the band because I want it to act almost as a template for the way that bands should be in the future. You get to a certain point, a certain success, and don't try and push it too far. And I think in interviews at the time, you were talking about the Stones, Jagger, strutting across stages at the age of...
I take all that back because he's brilliant, I think, and long may rock as well. It's just ain't for me, you know. I play a few old songs, a few of my old songs, which is good, and I enjoy doing that. But I could make a career out of it, do you know what I mean? It would do my head in, really.
And you're continuing to resist every offer to reform the band, and, and always will.
I have so far, yeah. Adding fuel to fire. No, there's no way it would happen. It's, you know, it would be absurd, you know. 50-something old geezers sort of jumping around the stage is just thing. You know, I mean, I am 50-something and I'm jumping around the stage, but it's in a different way of jumping. That's it. I'm jumping differently.
Brendan, you said there that decision to split the band ensured that the legacy was kept intact. You're happy that he hasn't gone back on that decision?
Well, I think so. I mean, I was only 10 when The Jam split up, and my mate who was with me now, he wasn't even born. We've often discussed about bands and stuff, and we're delighted, really, that it never actually happened, because, I don't know, because I look back at the stories, and my brother went, he went to one of The Jam last concerts, he was a few years older than me. And when you hear about it, it's like a magical mystery thing that we'll try to recreate it. I don't think it can ever be the same, really.
You can't recapture those things, you know. And also, why should you, though, as well? You know, if they meant so much to you and you got what the message was, it's like, keep moving forward. Well, almost every band, actually, has been getting back together in recent years because it's a big business and there's a whole very strange nostalgia trip going on. But it ain't for me.
Let's keep moving, then, in the words of the song. And we've got another question now. This one's from Daniel Ash.
I'm also a songwriter, but I occasionally get writer's block. Do you have any tips or advice on how you overcome it?
Drink. Bit my advice, haven't you? I don't know. Sometimes you just got to put it down for a bit, you know. You've got to walk away from it and then see what happens. And people say, you know, you can travel, you can go to a different environment, you can start detuning your guitar, you can, you know, there's different things. But I personally think it's either there or it's not there. And when it is, it's tough, I think. It's like a cycle of creativity.
How often have you had writer's block? Do you recognise it as writer's
block? Once a year for the last sort of 35 years or something, you know. But that's just part and parcel of it, really. When it used to happen when I was younger, it used to make me feel, you know, I used to be pulling my hair out. It's just like, oh, my God, it's gone. It's, you know, whatever I had is gone. But it doesn't go. Sometimes it just ain't happening for you and you just got to sit it out and wait.
But you wouldn't have known that at the time, say, after the split of the Style Council, before you moved on to your solo work. And I think you've talked about this before, that you almost forgot how to write songs, how to play the guitar. Was there an element of panic there, of my muse has gone?
I don't know if I was panicking. I was depressed by it because it was like, this is the thing that I've always done and always wanted to do, and all of a sudden I can't do it anymore. It's like, pick a guitar up and it didn't mean nothing to me, you know. But then I got it back by, in very practical terms, by just getting out on the road and working and gradually working through it and finding myself again, you know. But it was tough at the time.
And that work ethic, that idea of get back out there, that was instilled by your father then?
It was, yeah. His thing was, listen, you've got to go back out on the road and make some money because we need to make some money. I hated it at the time doing it. I hated going back to clubs and playing to only a few hundred people because my heart wasn't in it. But then all of a sudden, my heart was in it again, and I was writing songs, and I was excited again, and consequently, other people were, you know.
Mm. Let's have another question. This is from Sachin Ranjani.
Where would you rank yourself among Britain's greatest songwriters?
What number?
Well, top 10, definitely.
I agree.
Thank you. From all time, you mean, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, hopefully, at least scraping in sort of number 9 or 10, maybe, you know.
Who's above you?
John and Paul, obviously, you know, Bowie and all the greats, really. Ray Davies, obviously. All the people I like, really. All the people that have influenced me.
Yeah. Sachin, what number is he at, then?
I agree, top 10.
That's good enough for me. I'm happy with that.
Next question is from Jason Holmes.
To what extent do you think your best work is yet to come?
Well, I'd like to think it is. The reality of that doesn't matter to me. It's more that that propels me forward and makes me want to keep going, you know. And I think there's always been that element in me. Obviously, I'd like to write the perfect song, but I know that such a thing doesn't really exist, I don't think.
You're still looking for the perfect song, do you think?
Well, yeah, I think so, yeah. You know, if you've written a song which you consider to be great, naturally think as a human being, well, can I do it again? Could I make even better next time, you know?
Which ones have come close to perfection, do you think?
Wildwood is one of them for me, because it's so simple, you know. There's like four chords in it. Like an old folk song. So it's just that all the way through, and the only dynamic in the song really is the voice, and the voice, you know, is soft at first and it builds up, and I think that's great. To be that simple and yet so dynamic is quite hard to do at times.
Next question is from Nicola Wells.
You've talked a lot today about moving forward, but if you could relive one of your gigs from your career history, which one would it be and why?
The one from the last Saturday. Seriously, because it was just absolutely brilliant, you know. But it's always like that for me, to be quite honest with you. It's whatever the last great gig was. Last Saturday was as good as it gets to me, really. The band was playing fantastically and we were really totally in tune with the audience and we were all committed and a lot of passion. And
the jam gigs were riotous affairs. I mean, they're incredibly hot, fast, passionate. Do you have vivid memories of being on stage at those gigs or do they just pass in a blur?
Well, we did an awful lot, so they do kind of blur into each other. But generally, I couldn't necessarily say, oh, that was, you know, West Runton Pavilion or something. But the mood of it is always with me, you know, if I sit and think about it. They were just exciting right from the word go, you know.
Right.
I remember playing the So Bell Centre and I got so excited when I got on stage that I fell over.
Fell on your back?
Like a kid at a party, like that, you know.
You jumped on the monitors at the front of the stage and you fell flat on your back.
I was just so overwhelmed by the electricity in the gig and that and fell over. But
playing The Gift, in fact. You were playing the song The Gift.
Yeah, probably was, yeah.
I could tell you because I was in the front row.
I remember you now.
Elaine McGinty has our next question on a similar theme, actually, I think.
Many towns celebrate their musical heritage and your music and that of the Jam still attracts people from around the world to Woking. But you noted yourself that it's got no live music venue. Do you think there's a general lack nationally in the UK today of live music venues where new bands get to develop their sound and grow their audience?
I guess I'm a little bit out of touch with all that, but it's there's not as many places to play, you know. It's much tougher now than it was back in the 70s. Well, you could play every night of the week in London, for instance. But Woking's never been sort of exactly renowned for its live venues, is it? You know, that's why we ended up playing sort of workingmen's clubs and social clubs, because that's the only place you could get on a Friday or Saturday night, really.
Let's move on again. Next question is from Julia Wells.
Might need a little bit of imagination for this one. If you imagine swapping lives with fellow mod Bradley Wiggins for a minute, if you were cycling a stage of the Tour de France, what would be the 5 tunes in your headphones to push you over the finish line?
Ah, that's because Bradley had the Jam on his playlist, didn't he? And The Who and The Small Faces.
Really?
And he said it was you helped inspire him to the Tour de France win.
I don't know. Well, wouldn't like to do his job anyway, because it's hard work, isn't it? Probably put some sort of soul tunes on, you know.
And do you get out on the bike?
I've not been out on my bike for some years. My wife bought me a chopper, 1970s chopper, which is wicked as well. She bought me out about a couple of years ago, and I still haven't used it. But hopefully I'll get to sort of, you know, maybe I could ride my chopper with Bradley sometime. And
that's a race that people want to see, isn't
it? Yeah, especially downhill.
Let's finish up with a question from Paul Thompson.
What would the Paul Weller of 1982 think about the music Paul Weller is producing in 2012?
Well, I think as long as he didn't look at the front cover to see how old the Paul Weller of 2012 is, because I've been so biased against old people.
You were ageist, were you?
I was definitely, yeah, absolutely ageist, yeah. But I think otherwise I probably would like, I wouldn't like all of it, I'd like some of it, but I was so sort of convinced that, you know, people's lives had ended after 25 that I probably wouldn't have got that far, you know what I mean?
All the golden faces are under 25 was the line from the very first Jam single, In the City.
Yeah, even though I was blinkered in some ways, and musically as well, but that helped in lots of ways because it made me really focused and very definite about things, and I think that was important at that age to feel like that.
Yeah. I'm just going to throw the microphone at Alan Davis, who is just sitting behind there. Comedian and actor Alan Davis. I mean, a long-term Jam fan, weren't you? What was it? We've been talking about 1982 and The Gift and the band at the time. What was it about them and their sound that appealed to you?
I came across the Jam in a second-hand record store in Walthamstow, and I got a copy of That's Entertainment, which is a German import, and it had Tube Station Live on the back, and that was me hooked, and that was 1981. And then they didn't do an album that year. So I had to wait for The Gift to come round, and then you split it up, you bastard. So I went to the Wembley Arena gig. I went to that farewell gig. It's one of the great nights of my youth. And if I've got a question, it's you put two singles out in 81. There's Absolute Beginners and Funeral Pyre. Mm. What was Funeral Pyre about?
It was about the rise of fascists and the National Front and all that lot.
Yeah, it just had that great line, if you get too burnt, you can't go back home. And it was at the time, you were saying you didn't want to do an album on a tour, and I felt there was a bit of dissatisfaction in you. I used to lap up all the interviews. You know, I was an NME subscriber, and so, as you know, you were NME's Man of the Year every year for about 5 years in a row.
I thought it was a Woman of the Year 1 year as well.
You probably did get votes for that, yeah.
That's all we've got time for, I'm afraid. Thanks for your questions. Thanks to our audience here at Maida Vale.
Thank you.
Thanks most of all to Paul Weller for taking us back to the Jam's final album, The Gift. Don't forget the Master Tapes pages on the Radio 4 website. It will have exclusive content, photographs, videos, and you can download today's programme as well as the rest of the series, and you can tweet us using the hashtag BBC Master Tapes. We'll leave you with another live song from Paul Weller. This one, Paul, I think, well, it came out at the same time that you were recording The Gift. Alan Davis was talking about Absolute Beginners. This is the B-side. This is Tales from the Riverbank, then.
Hopefully, yeah.
Bring you a tale from the pastel fields where we ran when we were young. This is a tale from the water meadows, spreading love and joy into your heart. It's mixed with happiness, it's mixed with tears, both life.
And if you want to hear more material recorded at this Master Tape session, including exclusive performances, photographs and videos, go to the Master Tapes pages via the Radio 4 website.